Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 22 for January 23rd, 2007. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary science fiction and fantasy convention, and it's time for another podcast recorded at Conestoga 10. This time, I have the pleasure of bringing you Martin Wagner of sfreviews.net. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Merrill, your host, and today I have Martin T.M. Wagner, who is the reviewer of sfreviews.net, and he could be called a bit of a voracious reader. Welcome today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I guess the first question is you have a tremendous number of reviews on that website, and you also get a lot of hits. What possessed you to review websites, review books, and share them with the world?
Possessed. I think that's a really good term for it, I think. It's funny. I think initially it started out, well, I've actually been reviewing for some years when I was much younger and I was in fandom. I was living in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And when in my early college years, and actually as I think a high school senior or something like that. Anyway, I was getting full blown into science fiction fandom at that age, and I think the first thing that inspired me to write reviews was reading Spider Robinson's reviews, which were appearing in Analog at the time, mm-hmm. as well as Destinies, which was this magazine experiment that Jim Bain was doing at Ace Books at the time, where it was trying to do essentially a science fiction magazine, but in paperback book format. And Spider Robinson was writing these very, very chatty and friendly sounding science fiction book reviews, which essentially sounded like they didn't read like the sorts of they didn't read like stuffy academic criticisms, and they didn't read like the kinds of things you'd see in the newspaper, you know, film reviews or music reviews or what have you, where it was all just very straightforward. He sounded like a fellow just sitting there at the bar at the dinner table telling you about a book he'd read and being a real raconteur and sounding, being very funny and yet very honest with his opinions at the same time. And I didn't realize that reviews could be written that way. And that kind of made me think, well, that it sounds like it would be a fun thing to do. It would make reading fun. Take your reading experience and then express it to other people in that way. And so I did some of that, you know, at that age. And, yeah, I wasn't a very good critic at the time. You know. But, I gave it a good shot when I was 19.
Mm. Well, you have to start someplace and get experience somewhere.
Sure, yeah. But then at the time, I was involved with a little group of like-minded geeks called the Houston Science Fiction Society. A bunch of swell folks there. I remember them fondly. And they had a fanzine called Purple Obscenity.
Mm-hmm.
And I published some of my reviews in that. And then after sort of the HSFS kind of, you know, drifted as little groups like that will, I kept it going on. I published a fanzine for a while called Wagnerama, which is kind of a narcissistic name when I think of it at the time.
Well, I think it's a little better than Purple Obscenity.
Yeah. What is this? No, it's a Purple Obscenity gets you wondering, I guess. It's,
yes. I'm not sure I want to know how they came up with that title.
Yeah. Well, it's better than another one that that they had at the time called Kitty Torture Quarterly.
Okay.
But so that's when I was starting to write my reviews.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, I don't think I really got good at it until I was much, much older and everything. But at least it was a start. And it made, again, the process of doing that made reading more fun than just you're sitting down reading a book and it's this kind of passive experience. It's
mm-hmm.
a thing you're doing while you're killing time in between doing more important things or when you should be studying or doing your homework. And what happened was I think I missed it mainly. Yeah, and over the years, I had actually been involved in a few other things. After I got out of college, I was a cartoonist for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And during those years, I think mostly during the early to mid-90s, I had gotten away from reading as a hobby and missed it because I still loved it. And I felt like I was missing out on a lot of things, still not being as active a reader as I was in my youth. And so I thought, well, I still have a lot of these old science fiction paperbacks piled up in my house that I couldn't bring myself to get rid of, or at least I felt, well, I should read these before I get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I spent all that time and money collecting them when I was younger. And and at this point, the web was kicking in, right? This would have been about, I'd say 95, 96.
Yeah.
When I thought of doing it again. And so I actually started reading, I thought, well, I need to prep for this. So I didn't just launch the website right away. I thought, you know, I had huge ambitions. I wanted to launch the site with actually more reviews on it than it has now. Mm-hmm. But that ended up, you know, taking quite a long time. So I started reading for the site in, I think, spring of 97. And the first book I picked up, I just grabbed one at random off my pile, was mm-hmm. Home from the Shore by Gordon R. Dixon. That was the first – so that was like the first book I read to be an SFReviews.net reviewee. And started along with mostly the older stuff that I had piled around the house, and then began getting interested in newer science fiction mm-hmm. and discovering a lot of the new writers that had come along, since I had not been a very active science fiction reader, and having a lot of fun doing that. Now – you know, here I am. I launched the site in July of 2001, and so the site just had its fifth anniversary on the 1st of July.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you, yeah. And it had 140 reviews on it when I launched it, and now I just passed 440.
440 reviews. That's yeah. quite a few.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of, I think about it sometimes, and I'm like, you know, most other guys are out there like having careers and meeting women, and mm-hmm. it's like I feel really pitiful at times, but by golly, I've read all this great science fiction, and yeah, I wouldn't trade it for the world. It actually is. I mean, there are plenty of other things I do. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, kidding, but you know, just to have the experience of having I didn't just want to, again, I had all these old books, and I didn't just want to read them and then, okay, I've read it, and now I take it to Half Price Books and it's out of my life now. I wanted to at least have something to show for that experience.
Okay. And, well, I was going to ask you how many you had. 440 is what you have now. Mm-hmm. And you started off reviewing the older stuff, but now you've graduated, well, started reviewing the newer stuff. Do you go back and forth between old and new that you haven't read yet?
I do. I try to. I have found that since the industry has actually discovered my site, you know, and I now have the opposite problem. Of course, you know, originally I wanted to get old science fiction books out of my house, and that happened, and now it's just made way for this deluge of new books.
So they send you lots of review copies?
It's been wonderful. It's sort of the problem I wish I always had, but suddenly I have a room, one room in my house that I basically can't walk through.
Well, I do have one question here.
Sure.
And this is, I may have to cut this question out, but I seem to recall reading on, I looked at your website, and you don't read self-publish, right?
Well, that's not necessarily the case, and I'm glad you asked that, because to clarify, I do actually get the first kinds of books that started flooding my mailbox when the website had first been launched, and it wasn't yet high profile enough for the mainstream publishing
right.
industry to notice, were the small press and the self-published books. And that was kind of nice to get a lot of. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that there was that much activity going on. The sad thing is, of course, a lot of these small press, you know, they aren't edited, really. And this was at the point that I was discovering that the internet has, while it's been a boon, I think, to science fiction writers in many ways, there has also been kind of the, you know, the dark lining of the silver cloud, which is the print on demand publishing phenomenon that I think has given a lot of hopeful young writers the wrong impression of what it really takes to make it as a writer and what the publishing world looks for. And a lot of people, I think, have been deceived by slick advertising.
Oh, yeah.
And so what happens is I do get a lot of these books, and I've, in fact, I have actually set up a section of the website that I call Small Press Showcase to review these books on. There is not a lot that I have read for that section of the site, simply because the sad truth is the majority of the stuff that I get, I know that I can just open it up, read literally the first two sentences, and about 85% of them get screened out right there.
Mm-hmm.
I won't review a small press or self-published book unless I like it. You know, I read it and it passes the two sentence test right away.
Right.
And there are books that are, you know, every once in a while that there is you know, the wheat among the chaff, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
But my reason for only wanting to review a small press book if I know I'm going to praise it is because you know, I'm certainly have never been squeamish about panning a bad book. The small press books, aren't the sorts of things that get the distribution that mainstream titles do. Mm-hmm. You're not likely to stumble upon them unawares at Barnes & Noble and Borders mm-hmm. if you're just out casually shopping one day. So I see no reason to really waste space and bandwidth on the website by publishing a bad review of a book that you're not likely to see ever anyway.
Right.
And so I would much rather, for the small press showcase section of the site, review a book that deserves to be discovered, mm-hmm. you know, the little gem that you're obscure and that you ought to pick up. But of course, if you are coming from a major publisher, all bets are off.
Mm-hmm. Well, so. I just wanted to make one side comment. You know, I mean, the Conestoga podcast is mm-hmm. a fan-based podcast. There's no illusions that, you know, I mean, we are self-published ourselves, as mm-hmm. you know, we put it out
yeah.
on the web.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah.
we're not trying to make any money. Well, we're trying to get people to come to the convention, but, you know, hopefully, mm-hmm. you know, raising awareness of the convention.
Sure.
So I don't want to sound like, you know, being calling the pot calling the kettle black, but one of a well-known writer here in Tulsa is a firm believer in paying your dues. Mm-hmm. That I mean, you know, the editors and publishers are they're a form of gatekeeper, and they weed out the wheat mm-hmm. from the chaff so that we get a chance to read the better material that comes out. Now there are a few successes of self-published authors. I think the Christopher Paglioni, who's like 21 years old, wrote those Dragon books.
Right.
He self-published them, and then he became wildly successful. But that's – and there are a few other minor successes like that. But overall, mm-hmm. most self-publishing is, well, frankly, crap.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty dismal. And it's very, very sad when – probably I won't obviously mention the young lady's name, but
right.
I had a young lady send me her book, and not only did it not pass the two-sentence test, it didn't pass the two- or three-words test.
My goodness.
and another tragic mistake that this young lady made was she went through a firm called PublishAmerica.com, which is
Ooh.
Infamous. But again, the sad thing was she just kind of really didn't have a firm grasp on the concept. Literally on a daily basis for the following couple of months after she had sent me the review copy of her book, she was using my site search feature every day to search for her name. Whereas if you look at my website, it's pretty doggone obvious. You know, if any new review gets right there prominently noted,
right
there on the main page, here's the latest editions. So, you know, it's not like, oh, well, maybe he just didn't put my name there and I'm in, the review's up, but he forgot.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't forget. The problem is the book was just junk and it was sad. I was getting such a high volume of the small press and the self-published material mm-hmm. that I eventually had to put up this full guidelines page on my website where I essentially give these aspiring writers the reality check.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's what it really means. Yes, it's difficult to get published. It's difficult to make it as a writer. There is a reason for that. And I go through on the page and talk all about, you know, why it's the dues paying process has to be there and why sort of shortcutting it or trying to shortcut it by using these print-on-demand or these online publishers mm-hmm. is a very, very bad idea for people who really have serious career aspirations. And then I put sort of my little instruction list mm-hmm. in terms of, well, look, if you want to send me this material, here's how to do it. I'm perfectly happy mm-hmm. to consider your book for review, but here are the do's and don'ts. And that actually did cut the tide of review copies of stuff that I got. And the stuff that I'm getting now, there have actually been a couple of turns. I haven't actually added them to my slate yet, mm-hmm. but there were a few that I have gotten that have passed the two-sentence test fairly well
mm-hmm.
and look like they're actually promising little books. And the writers heed my instruction of please do not pack the envelope full of all of this press kit and all of this junk and material and biographies and especially blurbs from other reviewers that I just don't care about.
Mm-hmm.
I never read that stuff. You know, getting quotes from everybody and his dog and your English teacher is not going to influence me one way or another.
Right.
Or some fanzine or some other website. I go into any, you know, whether it's, you know, the new book by George R. R. Martin, or whether it's your book, mm-hmm. I want to go into it cold. I want to, you know, not be influenced by other opinions. And a lot of these writers are heeding that advice. And, you know, just one fellow sent his book in saying, you know, thanks for considering it. I know it may or may not get reviewed. I know the review may or may not be positive, but, you know, thanks for the consideration anyway. And I'm like, well, there you go. That's at least the professional attitude that I'd look for And he understands that I get at least 24 books in the mail from the major publishers, mm-hmm. you know, wanting to promote their writers, all of whom are more famous than Joe Blow with his self-published book. And so I'm glad to see that, you know, writers generally being literate people are getting the message. And I understand, you know, having the dream, mm-hmm. and I understand wanting to get the attention and the passion that goes into creating your work of art. I'm a creative individual too myself. Mm-hmm. We all want the same thing for our creation. But at the same time, I think we all just need to understand how the real world works at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn a lot of hard lessons when I was young and trying starting out with my cartooning and getting into some of my filmmaking exercises, which I'm glad that I'm doing as I'm older. Because mm-hmm. if I had done it when I was in my 20s or something like that, I think I would have made a lot of the same dumb mistakes that I see mm-hmm. young people and new people coming into a field making. So I understand the dream. Mm-hmm. And I just now ask the writer to understand the reality. And we can get a line. If your book is really, really good, I'll be the first one to tell mm-hmm. the world of science fiction, hey, here's this really terrific small press book that you need to pay attention to.
Well, that's excellent. I think that's a good philosophy. Feedback. Do you get do you find yourself getting an equal amount of positive and negative feedback, or what's the balance?
Well, the balance has actually been. I don't get a huge flood of feedback, mm-hmm. which is interesting. I know that, again, the site has now gotten reasonably high profile over the years, and so people are aware of it, and I'm sure that there are people out there who like it and who don't. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks, I think, can get a good overview of what my tastes are and how I review by reading the website. I haven't really gotten too much negative feedback. Mm-hmm. When you do. I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, if anybody needs to realize that that's what you get when you're out there, it's a mm-hmm. critic, because I'm, you know, if I don't like a book, that writer and that book will get negative feedback from me mm-hmm. by my writing a bad review. So it's just a part of the reality with it. And the positive feedback I get is very flattering. But what I like mostly is, and this is something that I think is an attribute that the internet provides that the old days of fanzines didn't really provide, because the internet, you have that sort of immediate connection uh-huh. with folks. And the way in which the internet has made the science fiction community, which has already been kind of closely knit and very clannish, mm-hmm. even more so because we're now all connected with our keyboards and can just talk back and forth to each other. So I have a forum on the website that gets a reasonable amount of traffic. And what I do like is when people... I'm having an excellent discussion in recent days over Robert Charles Wilson's Spin, which is only the 14th book out of over 440 that I've reviewed that I gave a 5-star review to. And some people, a couple of guys who didn't think it was quite all that good, didn't dislike it. But, you know, what we're having on my forum is a very intelligent discussion about the book. And that's the kind of thing that I like, when it's a back and forth. And, you know, with really good science fiction readers who I've always found, you know, the best science fiction readers are very astute, intelligent people in terms of being able to pick a story apart and talk about the things that in a story that works for them and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so we've had a really good back and forth in the spirit of, you know, we're a bunch of fans and we're respectful of each other's opinions and we actually like to hear. Mm-hmm. And I love to get that sort of thing where people are participating. You know, every once in a while you'll just get some. I think probably I can count. It's been very little, you know, maybe on the fingers of one hand with several fingers left over, you know, just these anonymous, really pissed off emails I've gotten. And that sort of thing you just kind of shrug off, because yeah. that comes with the territory. But what's interesting is that the more passionate feedback that I've gotten have been over reviews that have been very positive that I've written, not so much like the 1- and 2-star reviews. Mm-hmm. The only writers have also been very, very good in the feedback. Obviously, when I praise a book, I'll hear from the writer, mm-hmm. and he'll be very one of the funnier letters I got recently was, you know, Peter F. Hamilton wrote me, mm-hmm. and he said, My editor sent me the link to your review of Judas Unchained, and mm-hmm. she warned me to read past the first sentence, which I did, and so thank you for the great review. I loved the book. I absolutely uh-huh. loved the book, but I opened up by saying, look, talking about, look, this is a major act of writerly self-indulgence, this huge, 900-page, bloated, gloriously mm-hmm. overblown tome. But that's the appeal. That's what is charming and entertaining mm-hmm. about this book, is that it's just a writer cutting loose and not allowing any inhibition to hold him back. So that's been a really fun bit of feedback. And I remember getting a letter from Jack McDevitt, who was very gracious about a poor review I gave to his book Omega, which was a book that I loved right up until the ending, which is one of those endings that just infuriates you. It comes out of mm-hmm. nowhere, and it seemed to me to really kind of it was very disappointing the way he had built up this wonderful novel and then ended in a way that I didn't care for.
Kind of like he woke up and it was all a dream.
No, it wasn't like that. It was more a way of it was, well, again, not to give spoilers, but although the review is one of my few spoiler heavy reviews, because mm-hmm. it's when it's the ending of a book that blows the book for you, you can't really explain why you didn't like the book in the review unless you reveal the ending. So I did that, and it was one where I felt like he betrayed a lot of the themes that he was setting mm-hmm. up, and it struck me as being, this hard science book that ended with kind of almost an anti-science ending.
Mm-hmm.
Jack wrote me back saying, well, I didn't really intend this, and I'm sorry you felt that way mm-hmm. about the book, and I thought the ending was appropriate, but I appreciate your candor in the review, and you write with a lot of passion, and this is the only time I've ever written back. This is the second reviewer that I've only ever bothered mm-hmm. to contact in my entire career. And he and I ended up having, exchanging about two or three emails on it, and but he took it quite well, and I thought that was really nice. And a couple of other writers whose work I didn't like, have written back saying, well, I'm sorry you didn't like the book, but I appreciate the review and the honesty, and, mm-hmm. you really gave it a chance, and that was nice. I've only ever had one writer respond badly,
mm-hmm.
and, I won't talk about who that is, but, again, the fact that it's only been one, I think speaks well of the attitude that I guess most writers have in this genre, where you realize mm-hmm. when you are publishing books, and if you are an artist and you're putting your work out there in the world and it's going to be received by an audience, well, mm-hmm. You're going to get three responses from the public. Some people are going to love it, and some people are going to hate it, and then most people aren't going to care. But there are going to be those people out there who don't like your work and will express the opinion, and they understand. That's just life.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to go back up back up near to the beginning here. You said you were inspired by Spider Robinson, kind of wanted a friendly, chatty type reviews, maybe fireside review. I don't know what to call it. But anyway, I think one of the questions is, when you approach these reviews, do you have a philosophy of trying to avoid spoilers, or, so you don't ruin it you want to review it enough so that if it's whether they can decide whether they want to read it or not, but without really ruining it for the potential, someone who might who's looking to buy it.
No, I understand what you mean. Art of reviewing, the art of reading, books are like children. Mm-hmm. Everyone is different. Yeah, and I find that I have not really been able to just apply a one-size-fits-all philosophy to everything. Sometimes, as I mentioned, for example, the Omega review being a good example of this,
mm-hmm.
a situation where I couldn't really explain what it was I disliked about that book without revealing the ending. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I put a whopping great spoiler warning.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think my warning on that review says, get ready for a rant. And by the way, okay. This is a spoiler-heavy review. And then there are other times, I'll say mild spoilers, and sometimes if there's just one sentence, a point that I need to make, here's one thing that bugged me, but it's a bit of a spoiler, so you can do this wonderful magic thing that websites allow you to do, which is I print the text in white on the white background, so you have to highlight the text to read it. So all these little wonderful tricks that the web lets you do that you can do in something mm-hmm. like a fanzine or a magazine. But certainly for the most part, I try not to reveal spoilers and things that would ruin mm-hmm. the reading experience, because part of the reason I'm reviewing is I want people to have the reading experience for themselves. And even getting away from the aspect of spoilers, with some reviews that I write, I may or may not have a detailed plot synopsis. Mm-hmm. I may have a very the plot may I may be able to go through it just very quickly. I try to do that in general. I don't like reviews where it's just a long in-depth plot synopsis mm-hmm. and then maybe a paragraph at the end saying, well, this was really nice, but I didn't like it as much as the guy's other book or something like that.
Okay.
Sometimes a plot can be really intricate, and in order to make sense of it, I'll need to go into some details. But what I'll try to do is I'll give a basic synopsis, and then I'll start intercutting that with my views of how well the writer is doing what he's doing, conveying the ideas and the themes and the plot, and I'll try to interweave opinion with synopsis, and then to give readers the big picture
okay.
of how I think about the thing. But I've never, on the whole, yes, I don't like to do spoilers, and I try to avoid them when I can. But I found that reviewing, you can't really apply a one size fits all philosophy.
Okay, well, thank you, Martin.
Sure.
I think we have just about covered SF reviews, and you've given me an excellent insight into how you operate. Before we started this interview, you mentioned that you were working on a feature documentary, so you don't just review books.
Right, right. I've always actually had aspirations to be a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and that's something that I'm very actively pursuing. And SFReviews.net is a hobby that made good, as mm-hmm. it were, and so it's a wonderful thing to kind of occupy my time. I try not to be someone who spreads myself too thin mm-hmm. over too many projects, but I think if I can sort of divide my time between reviewing science fiction online, which is my very relaxing and wonderful activity, and then marry that to the that'll be the other side of the coin with the high pressure work that comes mm-hmm. with filmmaking. Sure, it's been an aspiration of mine actually since I was as a college student, 18, mm-hmm. 19 years old. I was a film student, film major in school, mm-hmm. and but then I took a long detour into cartooning in the 90s. Which taught me the art of visual storytelling, and which taught me also a lot about just how tough the real world is and the real business of trying to be a working artist. Oh. And so when the cartooning went by the wayside and I gave mm-hmm. that up, I decided, well, maybe I can take now the knowledge that I've learned, the skills I've developed, A, in visual storytelling, B, in understanding how art and industry are intermarried. Writing novels, making films, being a musician, mm-hmm. They are both an art and a business if you mm-hmm. intend to do them professionally. And you need to learn to wear both hats. And, mm-hmm. of course, young artists are all obsessed with being an artist, an artiste, mm-hmm. and my art. And you kind of expect the world to sort of, I see so many of these guys at film festivals and things mm-hmm. I go to where, want to be young directors in their 20s, and they're just convinced that if once the world sees their movie and gets to bask in their genius, then it will all fall into place for them. Mm-hmm. And you see very young writers mm-hmm. and novelists doing the same thing and making the same, having the same attitude. And uh-huh. no, I mean, reality just doesn't work that way. And so I'm actually glad that when I realized that maybe I could take some of my visual storytelling skills and go back to the film aspirations that I mm-hmm. thought I had given up in my late 20s, early 30s, mm-hmm. actually make a go of it, knowing a little something about how it works out there, then it was just a matter of time. It was all about finding what would be the right project for mm-hmm. me to start with. I actually got as many jobs as I could working on film crews, just very mm-hmm. low-level positions, production assistant, assistant director, mm-hmm. on a lot of projects that shoot in the Austin area, my hometown, just to learn how film sets work.
Uh-huh.
So I've worked on everything from feature films all the way down to television commercials, reality shows, done a little bit of everything, just running around on a film set, sweating and getting my hands dirty just to learn the mechanics of the business. Because, again, I didn't want to be one of these 21-year-old wannabe Orson Welleses mm-hmm. that you see at film festivals who think they're brilliant directors, but they haven't spent a day on a film set. Mm-hmm. This has all been part of my education. And after, I'd say, maybe about 10 years of false starts and scripts that weren't really any good, mm-hmm. dreadful, and all the way up to right up to last year when I was very actively pursuing a short film project that the financing fell through on, I finally settled on something I never thought I would consider, which is a feature documentary mm-hmm. to be my first project, and I've started work on that now.
Well, we're running out of time here, but
okay.
To wrap it up, what can you tell me, tell us about that feature documentary? I guess what's the subject matter, and when do you plan to have it completed so that we can see it?
Sure. Well, It would be wonderful to be able to bring the final cut of it to Conestoga next year for a screening, but again, you never know how that's going
to
pan out.
Well, you'll have to talk to Tim Fraser about that. He's in charge of our film festival.
Right. But the the film's called Bloody Work, and it's about the 1885 serial killings that took place in Austin, Texas. Three years before Jack the Ripper, we had our own down in Austin. They were, I think it was actually, the evidence is pretty clear that it was a couple of, at least two, and could have even been more killers who went around and ended up being known as the Servant Girl Annihilators because they were breaking into homes and doing these incredibly brutal murders of these African-American servant women. And they were just savage killings. And it went pretty much through the entire year of 1885 and ended up actually with the killings of two white women. At which point, you know, you read the original newspaper accounts, and the response is sort of like, "Uh-oh, now we have a problem on our hands," because uh-huh. you know the attitudes of the day.
Unfortunately, that attitude is still around.
Yeah, sadly. Although Austin at the time was a fairly progressive city in terms of race relations, although there was still very much ingrained racism, and it just got a lot worse because the killings went unsolved. Mm-hmm. So there are these unsolved crimes that are also forgotten in time. Because, obviously 3 years later, Jack the Ripper came along and became this world celebrity murderer, I guess you could say. And so that completely overshadowed what had gone on in Austin. And then he also, I think, had the following decade, you had H.H. Holmes and then other. And then over time, just a century has passed and it has just been lost. You'll find people in Austin, if you walk down the street in Austin and ask 25 people, have you heard of the Servant Girl Annihilators? The odds are 24, and maybe even all 25 of them will say, no, I never heard of this. So people just don't know. It's this lost episode in Austin history, and because it's unsolved, I became one of the geeks who haunt the old Austin libraries, looking through microfilms of 1885 newspapers.
Wow!
And I thought it would made a and it is the more I'm discovering about it, it makes such a fascinating subject for a documentary because, of course, not only do you have these horrible killings. Yeah, and just increasing in ferocity. I mean, the murders are also known as the Austin Axe Murders, so that should tell you something.
Okay.
And like I said, victims ranged all the way. The worst victim of all was this little 11-year-old girl, and she's the only. There is actually you can still find her headstone in Oakwood Cemetery, which is the old cemetery that's still around in Austin.
Well, I don't think we should get into too much details,
but in addition to the killings, we have these nine known victims and possibly more attempted victims, but there was just the staggering official incompetence in pursuing these guys, why were these guys so hard to catch? What you find is just a spectacular amount of official idiocy going on with with what passed for the police department in Austin at the time. There were essentially no more than four officers on the beat at any given time, and most of these guys were hanging out at the whorehouses in Guytown, which was Austin's red light district. And the police chief was essentially this corrupt boob. And it eventually got to the point where you did almost have the mobs in the streets. There were, in fact, after the last few killings, there were up to 1,000 people. Essentially we're laying siege to the governor's mansion saying, do something about this, or we'll do something about this. And then just the incompetence spread to the prosecution. Well, the last victims, there were two white women murdered on the same night, Christmas Eve, 1885. Both their husbands were arrested for the killings, and the prosecution came up with this boneheaded idea that these women had actually been killed by their husbands. And we were expected to believe, the public, that independently these two men had conceived of the idea that I'll murder my wife and I'll make it look like these killings that have been going on all year. You know, sort of like both of them had, I guess, kind of some sort of osmotic. And then they pursued these prosecutions with just complete incompetence. They even had this O.J. Simpson glove moment in the courtroom where one of the husbands... They'd found a bloody footprint outside one of the murder scenes. And the footprint was just too big for the husband's feet. And so the prosecutor, got up and continuing to make a fool of himself, saying, well, obviously the reason that the footprint is bigger is because he was carrying the body of his wife, and so there was more pressure pushing the foot down and made the footprint bigger. And so, the accused just stood up and literally picked up his lawyer in his arms and stood on the impression of the footprint. And by golly, it still wasn't big enough. And so you had this spectacle in the courtroom where it really is one of the most incompetent prosecutions you'll ever see. And it's fascinating to this whole soap opera ends up developing after the killings are over, having to deal with the bungling of the prosecution, sort of the life of the last couple of victims, especially the last victim, a woman named Eula Phillips, and some things that were going on in her life at the time. And it's just this fascinating story of prosecutorial ineptitude and official corruption, and all tied to this very, very sad incident, you know, where it seemed like the earlier victims no one really cared about. But
well, Martin, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm going to have to get ready for the next interview here.
That's fine. That's fine.
But I really appreciate you coming here and allowing me to interview you, and I'm certainly looking forward to that film, and also I have to check out your website again. And of course, that's sfreviews.net.
sfreviews.net.
And the other one is martinwagner.com.
Actually, WagnerFilm.com, I've still got the URL for it, but I haven't actually launched the site.
Oh, okay.
But I'm like everyone else and their dog, I'm on MySpace, which is at myspace.com/exit272, which is a page on the MySpace film section that is just devoted to the film work. And that's where I'm going to be promoting the film mostly until I actually get an official website up for it and just posting production updates. Such as I schedule interview subjects. It's fascinating putting a documentary together and the mechanics of it and come up with some really good ideas for how to do it. And so I think it's a thing that people will enjoy when they get a chance to see it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Be sure to check out sfreviews.net to see Martin's very considered opinion on what is worth reading. To find out more about his movie project, Bloody Work, go to myspace.com/exit272. I think it's safe to say, looking forward to seeing you all at Conestoga 11, so thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org, or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.